Diane, and it's great to be back with you. On my mind this week, indeed, all week long, we've been inundated with huge stories.
At those stunning tweets from the president accusing President Obama of tapping his phones during the campaign.
One after the other.
WikiLeaks today posting a giant trove of CIA documents.
We've had very little time to absorb each one.
New information about the House Republican bill to repeal and replace Obamacare.
Before yet another breaks. So here to talk about being whipsawed by major developments and to talk about the stories themselves, Molly Ball of The Atlantic and Michael Shear of The New York Times. Later in the show, I catch up with one of my favorite writers, George Saunders. I'm actually in San Antonio today. Molly Ball and Michael Shear are in Washington. Molly and Michael, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Diane.
Happy to do it. Absolutely.
Thank you. Honestly, it does feel as though we're being whipsawed. Tim Wu of Columbia Law School wrote, "It's impossible not to watch every day the Trump administration seemingly brings another plot twist, a new initiative, outlandish attack, or bizarre reversal. Not since wartime has news been so riveting, and with the president fighting so many enemies, it is actually not unlike war coverage." What's your reaction to that, Michael?
Well, I can definitely attest to the craziness of it just from the lack of sleep that we're all getting. I think I can speak for probably Molly as well, but all reporters in Washington, I mean, we're just, you know, the pace is kind of never ending. It doesn't respect the days of the week or the typical hours that one might find to go to sleep. Now, that's somewhat true of the presidency at any point, and no matter who the occupant is. But, you know, I was with the president in Palm Beach over this last weekend when he started tweeting at just after 6:30 in the morning his accusation that the president, the former president, Barack Obama, had tapped his phones and calling him a sick man and a sad man. And the moment that started, it really launched a whole series of stories. As you say, it was kind of hard to even keep up with the developments, but trying to figure out where did that come from? What was he really saying? Where did he get the information? Did he have some kind of evidence or supporting briefings from the intelligence community to back it up? And then, of course, the next day, the story that we broke about Comey and an FBI director and what his reaction to all that was. So it just, you know, each time you think you can take a breath, there's something else.
And Molly, what about you?
I would agree with that impression. I would say I think in the eyes of the administration, this is a feature, not a bug, because they see it as evidence that Trump has sort of come into office with this shock and awe, this full court press, this giant menu of things that he's going to do all at once. And I learned from covering the Trump campaign that this is a man who has a much higher tolerance for chaos than most people, including most reporters, and who is very good at creating chaos, who's very good at this, at sort of throwing bombs, watching the cloud of dust that erupts and then going off and setting another one off somewhere else. One of the things that I've written about, though, is that while this creates an impression of action, a lot of what he's doing is simply creating controversies based on things he has said, you know, sort of bluster and trash talk, while not actually doing a whole lot. In policy terms, it's not the case that this is a sort of historically substantive first month and a half of the presidency.
So, Michael, how much of what you see happening do you think is something of a calculated strategy on the part of Trump and Bannon to keep as many people off balance as possible?
I totally agree with Molly that there is some history here of a strategic nature of how they've approached. They certainly approached the campaign and keeping people off balance, and I think they sort of came into the White House thinking that they would do the same thing. And so I think if you look back at the myriad of things that have happened over the first, you know, 5 or 6 weeks of the administration, there's definitely some instances of that kind of strategery, if you will. But I think we have to separate out the ones that are and the ones that aren't. And my strong impression is that what happened this weekend had nothing to do with any sort of broader strategic notion of what they wanted to accomplish. I think this was all about President Trump being in a foul mood from the day before and kind of being fed a bunch of stuff from Breitbart that he just popped off about. And in fact, there's some reporting that we have in our paper today that suggests that the staff was caught off guard as much as we all were and immediately started having conference calls to try to figure out what to do about it and how to contain it. And, you know, I can't say for 100%, maybe there's some grand theory here or some grand strategy that I'm not privy to, but it sure looks like this was one of those times that just is owing to this particular president's tendency to sort of say things that come into his mind. And of course, his method of saying is Twitter. And so then that's a pretty big megaphone that goes to a lot of people. And it sets off, as Molly said, these sort of kind of explosions. This one I can't see much purpose to.
Seems to me that the White House staff is in kind of a tough spot when they're pressed on why President Trump said what he did about wiretapping at the Trump Tower. Was or has there been any indication that is indeed a fact?
No. There has been evidence reported in our newspaper and in other organizations, by other organizations, of associates of Mr. Trump's who have been picked up in surveillance, not targeting them directly or not targeting Trump Tower or certainly the president himself, but have been picked up in other ways. For example, the one that most people know about is that General Flynn, who had been the National Security Advisor, was picked up in conversations with the Russian ambassador. Of course, the Russian ambassador was the one targeted for surveillance, not Mr. Flynn, but when he had a conversation with the ambassador, those conversations were picked up. In some ways, the listeners might think, okay, well, that's not a very big difference, but it is. It's a huge difference. It really changes the way, and U.S. law is very clear on the fact that there are things that the government can do to monitor foreign individuals that they can't do to folks in the United States or certainly United States citizens. So,
all right, but let me just pose a hypothetical there then. Could it be possible that Donald Trump was, in fact, talking with a Russian official, and that's what got picked up, and that's what now President Trump has found out?
It is possible. That is certainly possible. And we have tried in our coverage, and I think we've all tried as a press corps, to be very careful in our and very precise in what we're reporting and what we're not reporting. It is certainly possible that that happened, although the logic of President Trump calling attention to that would just escape me, right? Because if what he's talking about, if he thinks that there are actually conversations that he's not disclosed before that are between him and Russian officials, why in the world would he want to call attention to that? He's been denying that for months, for weeks and months. So, you know, again, that's possible, I guess, but it would seem like a strange strategic approach to raise that and to get people interested in investigating that. And in fact, a call for Congress to investigate and to include the question of wiretapping of him in an investigation, if he knows, in fact, that there's something on there that would be damaging to his political fortunes.
Molly, what's your take?
To me, the issue here is not so much that there is a hypothetical possibility that Trump may be right in some technical sense, but that he appears to have made this assertion not based on any evidence, But based on there's some conflicting reports, but based on something that came out of sort of right wing media and that he never even sought substantiation for, a president has huge resources at his disposal to look into things and figure out if they're true before he says them publicly. And in this case, as Michael was saying before, we have a president who we know from our reporting and from observing him over the long term is highly impulsive and does not wait for all of the evidence to line up before he makes allegations like this, which are not only inflammatory but extremely serious in their implications. So there will be probably an investigation, and the types of things that Michael is talking about with the different ends of the calls that may have been wiretapped may indeed come out. But as you noted, his staff was caught off guard by this. It wasn't something that they planned out as a public statement based on something that had been researched. He just sort of came out with it based on something he'd heard. And that's the really sort of troubling part. And it's a pattern for Donald Trump.
And what is the status of these investigations? Of course, we've heard the president call for congressional investigation into possible Russian interference in our elections, but now adding this to it, what's the status, Michael? Where is it now?
Well, and this gets to another really confusing part about why he would do this. But, you know, up until the weekend, you had the dynamic where the Republican-led committees in the House and Senate were, you know, going to open an investigation. They sort of have to, but they were very much pushing towards the idea that the investigations would be more about leaking and less necessarily about the substance of the Russian contacts. That's where the Republicans would have hoped to push the investigation. You know, after this weekend, it's much, much harder for the Republican chairman of the committees not to acknowledge that they really have to delve into the substance of the Russian contacts. I mean, they have the current sitting president of the United States alleging a wiretapping scheme orchestrated by the previous president of the United States. I mean, that's the substance of the question of whether or not there were contacts with the Russians. And so those investigations are inevitably going to go forward. You know, the Democrats would like them to go forward under a special prosecutor. I still think that the Republicans are probably not going to let that happen, and so that we'll have some months of hearings. I think there's already been one. The House Intelligence Committee has said they want to have an early hearing, and they've in the next week or two, and they've invited the FBI director and other top officials to testify in public session. So, you know, one of the next steps here is going to be we're going to hear from the FBI director himself.
So, Molly, would you agree no special prosecutor?
I don't think we know at this point how far the Republicans who are in charge of all these committees will go. So far, there has not been a willingness, but we know that, I think, as Michael said, it's exactly right. There was an impulse to defend the president of their party at first, and we have seen the Republicans in the House and Senate become more and more troubled by this issue of the contacts with the Russians, more and more willing to take it on in a public way. And so there is a public hearing of the House Intelligence Committee on the Russian contacts now scheduled for March 20th, later this month, that calls a number of high-profile witnesses, has the potential to be embarrassing for the White House, depending on what turns up. So at this point, we have not seen the calls for a special prosecutor accelerate to the point where it looks like it will get anywhere. But I don't think the door is closed.
And Michael, what about the WikiLeaks release on CIA hacking methods? Doesn't this sort of complicate the whole picture? How damaging is it to our security, embarrassing to the agency? I mean, talk about news breaking one day after another.
Certainly embarrassing to the agency, right? That's. I mean, I think it's hard to imagine that it's not. On the question of how damaging it is, I've talked to some of our folks who cover this regularly, and I think that question is still very much up in the air. Sometimes these leaks are of documents that are, you know, more widely known anyway, or that stuff that's been reported on anyway, I think that it's going to take some time. This was thousands and thousands of pages of documents, and supposedly WikiLeaks has more. So I think it's going to take some time to assess exactly how much is there and is damaging. I will say that what's clear, though, and damaging, you know, you have yet again a sort of the President of the United States in a very strange place, because we're all going back to the many, many, many videos of the president at campaign rallies during the presidential campaign, in which he gleefully stood up there and said, "I love WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is the greatest thing. Isn't WikiLeaks the best thing ever?" Because at the time, WikiLeaks was leaking information from his rival's campaign, from the Democratic National Committee and from John Podesta, who was a top aide to Hillary Clinton. And so you now have this bizarre situation where the sitting president of the United States has declared this leaking organization, this hacking organization, the greatest thing since sliced bread, and now it's targeted against his own intelligence community. And I think it's going to dog the president throughout his presidency.
If I could jump in for a second.
Sure.
I don't think that those are necessarily contradictory things, given that this White House believes it to be, in a way, at war with the intelligence community. The Trump White House believes that they are being undermined by holdovers from the Obama administration in the national security agencies who are selectively leaking things in order to undermine the president. So it is potentially of a piece with the Trump administration's negative view of elements of the intelligence community that WikiLeaks is now seeking to undermine the intelligence community.
And at the same time, we're watching the effort this week to rally congressional Republicans around the proposed alternative to the Affordable Care Act. How tough a road is that going to be, Molly?
Healthcare reform is a really, really hard thing to do, as anybody who covered it when the Obama administration tried to do it can attest. The way that they've gone about this is very curious, to sort of come up with a bill and then hatch it fully formed and let everybody pile on it, instead of sort of trying to bring all the stakeholders into a room and get everybody to find common ground in the first place. And so the bill now finds itself under attack seemingly from all sides. Conservatives think it's too liberal. Liberals think it's too conservative. The White House has said they're going to get behind it, but a lot of Republicans in the House don't feel they have the leadership or support that they would like to have from the president. And so at this point, the bill as it stands is on the rocks, but the bill as it stands is only a first draft. And what we don't know is what could be hashed out to make it more palatable to various critics.
But doesn't it seem clear that fewer people are going to end up having insurance? And because of Medicaid changes in our country, the poorest among us are going to bear the greatest burden, Michael.
I mean, I think if you take the bill on face value and were to wind the clock forward and say this would be what actually becomes law, I think the answer to that is clearly yes. And some of our colleagues in the press have done analyses of, okay, if this actually went into effect, this is how it would affect different income groups and different age groups. And it appears that poor people and kind of especially poor elderly people fare the worst under this, especially, although it's unclear exactly how it would play out, but after 2020, this bill would basically phase out the payments that the federal government makes to the states for Medicaid and essentially let the states decide how to spend that money. And so you can imagine some states would still use that money to provide a lot of care for Medicaid and others would pull back on it. So, but as Molly says, I totally agree. Like, this is, I think, just very much a step one. They may have tried this way because they recognized the challenge that the Obama administration got into, which is sort of the flip side of the challenge, which is they sort of tried to develop the bill. They never put forward a fully formed bill at the beginning, and then it it took forever, and it wound through various committees, and it got sort of, you know, piecemeal eaten at, away at as well. So it could be the Trump administration looked at that and said, hey, you know, we're better off just putting something out all at once and seeing what happens. But if that's what they thought, it didn't quite work out that the way they wanted.
And what about the new travel ban? This one, they say they've tailored to overcome the objections to the prior one, but the critics say it's likely to meet the same fate, Michael.
They certainly did make some changes that, for a layman like myself, looks like they at least addressed some of the concerns that the circuit court had initially had with the first ban. Whether that's enough to satisfy a more liberal circuit court like the Ninth Circuit, and ultimately, you know, if something were to go to the Supreme Court, I don't know. I'm certainly not a lawyer, but the administration believes that they've done enough to satisfy those concerns, and I guess we'll see.
And Molly, tax reform, infrastructure, spending, all those things that Donald Trump was talking about, he wanted to accomplish very quickly. They're now looking as though they're a long way off.
Yes, if they get done at all, it will take a long time, and that's normal. It's hard to believe it was just last week that Trump was giving that big speech to the Congress where he laid out all of these priorities. These are big things. It's hard to do big things. Our system is set up in a way to make it hard to do big things. I think if anyone is surprised that it will be hard to do these things if they can be done at all, it's because Trump sold a mythology, an impossible idea that you could have a businessman and a deal maker who came in and made things happen all at once, right? Who sort of just busted up the gridlock through sheer force of will. And I think what we're seeing in the early going of his presidency is that that's not possible, and the governing is you know, a lot harder than that myth would have people believe.
And indeed, I think you've said so far, instead of President Trump shaking up Washington, it's been more the other way, so that Trump has had to bend mostly to Republicans in Washington.
Yeah, I really think so far the things that Trump has been able to accomplish have been the things that Republicans want him to do. So the Republican-controlled Senate approving most of his cabinet nominees. His Supreme Court pick has not yet been confirmed, but has been greeted very favorably among Republicans on Capitol Hill. What we haven't seen, and what the health care bill may be the first test of, is what would happen if Donald Trump and the Republican majorities in the House and Senate come into conflict. Who would win that battle? Would Trump, with his outsider status and lack of knowledge of the process and thinly staffed administration, be able to take on that behemoth of the system and defeat it? Or would it defeat him? And so we don't know yet, but a lot of the things he's done so far, you know, the first travel ban executive order that got slapped down by the courts, that has sort of been a triumph of the system versus the outsider who tried to tame it.
Michael Shear, Motley Bull, thank you both for helping me understand what's going on in Washington and helping me cope with the questions I have on my mind. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you,
Diane. Happy to do it.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
We're back. And now, a conversation with one of my favorite writers. You may know George Saunders as the author of the widely acclaimed collection of short stories, 10th of December. He's just written his first novel. It's called Lincoln in the Bardo. It's a wildly imaginative story of a deeply bereft President Lincoln who visits the crypt containing the body of his beloved son, Willie. I caught up with George, who was in a car in Minnesota, but just to be clear, he was not driving, but was a passenger. George, it's great to talk to you again.
Diane, it's always great to talk to you.
Thank you. The title of the book, Lincoln in the Bardo. I had never heard that word. What does it mean?
It's a Tibetan word that means transitional zone or space. So really, we're in a Bardo right now, the Bardo between birth and death. But usually in that tradition, when they use that word, they take it to mean the one that starts at the moment of your death and then proceeds until whatever happens next, whether it's reincarnation or some kind of ascent into heaven or whatever we deserve, I guess.
Sort of a kind of purgatory.
It is, although as a former Catholic, my understanding of purgatory is it's a little more harsh. You know, but purgatory is kind of, you go sit on a hard bench until the end of days. but the Bardo is a little more, I don't know if it's negotiable, but it's a little more transactional. you're sort of there directly because of the cause and effect of essentially the way your mind is working right now.
Well,
what determines, what happens later.
And I know you have a fabulous imagination, but talk about how this story actually came to you.
Well, many years ago in D.C., I'm sure you know this place well, on Rock Creek Parkway, you can drive by Oak Hill Cemetery, and you look up a hill, and there's a series of crypts just perched on the top of the hill there. And
I know it well.
Yes, and that farthest one to to the east by the Carroll family crypt, and that's where little Willie Lincoln was kept for 3 years after he passed away. And just a friend of the family said, did you know that Lincoln was so grief-stricken that he actually went into that crypt on several occasions, according to the newspapers, and some said that he had actually held the body. So this was 20 years ago I heard this story, and it just got in my head, and I, as much as I tried to push it away because I thought it might be too earnest or too difficult, it just kept showing up, especially weirdly at moments of artistic happiness. I would kind of be like, why can't I do that, So about 2012, I just thought, you're 53 and you're not getting any younger, so you don't want to be the guy whose, own gravestone says, too afraid to try the things you really wanted to try. So I just gave myself a little 3 months sort of grant, of time to just try it.
Well, and George, it's just wonderful. And it's so, somehow, it's inviting all of us to imagine along with you. And the idea of imagining a cemetery as kind of a village with basically random people side by side.
That's a beautiful emotion. I love that. And, the one sort of unifying thing is that none of them quite, unlike us, none of them quite got what they wanted in this life. And they had regrets and neuroses, and they had places where they got stuck. So this is kind of the subset of all the people who were buried there, but who somehow weren't, somehow in the proper relation to their own life at the moment of death. And so they linger a little bit.
Would you read for us from the start of chapter 16? I find this fascinating. You'll have to set it up for us because there are numerous voices speaking.
Yes, this section is actually, if you see it on the page, it's three different ghosts who are friends kind of talking back and forth. But I won't try to do the voices, but I'll just indicate the change of speaker by a little pause.
Sure.
So these ghosts are sitting there, and suddenly Willie Lincoln looks up, and much to their surprise, he calls out, "Father," and they all turn their heads, and then we hear this. An exceedingly tall and unkempt fellow was making his way toward us through the darkness. This was highly irregular. It was after hours. The front gate would be locked. And the boy had been delivered only that day. That is to say, the man had most likely been here quite recently. That afternoon. Highly irregular. The gentleman seemed lost. Several times he stopped, looked about, retraced his steps, reversed course. He was softly sobbing. He was not sobbing. My friend remembers incorrectly. He was winded. He did not sob. He was softly sobbing, his sadness aggravated by his mounting frustration at being lost. He moved stiffly, all elbows and knees. Bursting out at the doorway, the lad took off running toward the man, look of joy on his face, which turned to consternation when the man failed to sweep him up in his arms as, one gathered, must have been their custom. The boy instead passing through the man as the man continued to walk toward the white stone home, sobbing. He was not sobbing. He was very much under control and moved with great dignity.
That is quite an image, George. And tell me...
And right on cue, we have an ambulance passing by us.
I hear that ambulance. I hear it. So how did that scene come to you in your heart and in your mind?
I'm at the phase now where I need to talk about the book, and it's really hard because it sort of, I could best describe it as a kind of welling up. I would go into the writing room every day and almost just throw open a valve, and these, I don't want to sound crazy, but the voices came to me fairly naturally, and I found myself just almost, not exactly channeling in any kind of strange sense, but just these voices were very available to me. And the love that Lincoln had for his son was kind of the driver. And my goal along the way was just to honor that original image, you know, of him holding the body and try to not do anything in the book that wouldn't somehow increase our engagement with that moment. So it's a kind of a strange book formally. I didn't mean for it to be, but I always had this sort of mantra that everything had to be in the service of that parental love. And then the book sprouted all these very strange tropes and devices and so on.
But didn't it, to a certain extent, involve your getting inside the head of Abraham Lincoln?
It sure did. And that it's quite daunting because there's been so much written about him. But the great thing about fiction is that you are always being led away from the abstract to the concrete. So if I thought, okay, now it's time to say something new about Lincoln, I just would jump off a cliff. But to say, no, okay, that's not the job. The job is when Lincoln comes into the scene, we're going to ask what time it is, how does he feel, what's he wearing, what's the weather like. So by tightening the gaze, you can sort of wriggle out of the burden of making a new Lincoln, but you can maybe describe a particular Lincoln at a particular time. And then, of course, part of what you're doing is, you know, you can't help but fuse your phenomenon with his. So I knew quite a bit about him, and I'd read a lot to get his prose rhythms and sort of the under logic of his thinking. But then at the critical moment, of course, you're infusing him with your own stuff, you know, your own emotions, your own memories and longings. So it's that kind of, it's almost an alchemy that you do in fiction. And since the goal really isn't to make a Lincoln, but the goal is to try to move you, the reader, into some new space where we're very close together, you and I, and where something new and truer than true is happening, then you can sort of let yourself off the hook of verisimilitude, I think. That was the plan, anyway.
Were you, if I may ask, also thinking about your own mortality as you wrote this?
I was, very much so. And also, of course, you know, of the mortality of all the people that I love. The reason I loved working on this book is because I got to go in every day and write about or around the thing that seems most alive to me right now, which is this notion that we seem to be put here to love one another. We're very good at it. You know, in moments of need, where does the mind go? It goes to the people you love. Well, that's wonderful. And then, of course, we all become maybe increasingly aware that those connections are very tenuous and they're very conditional. So what I find myself thinking about is, you know, now that the sweet joy of youth has worn off, how does one maintain positivity and productivity and love in the face of this sort of oncoming train of our own mortality? So it was a great privilege to be able to march over to my little writing shed every day and know that whether I liked it or not, those are the questions that I was going to have to deal with.
You know, it was interesting that the characters in your book sort of seemed to want to move the process along. They wanted the father and the son to somehow reunite.
In fiction, my policy is always try not to have any big ideas when you start. I know we've talked about this before. Just leap in and trust that there's some kind of artistic subconscious that's smarter and better hearted than I am. So you launch in. And one of the amazing, for me, surprises about this book was exactly what you just mentioned. I didn't really have it in mind that these ghosts would have much of an active role in the book. I couldn't quite imagine what it would be since they're ghosts. But almost of their own volition, they all started contributing in the project to sort of protect this young boy. And so I have no idea how that happens. I know for me, on a technical level, it's just close line editing and iteration. But it's so wonderful, you know, that you make this world up and then the world actually starts teaching you something. So I've been very aware since I finished the book, and maybe, you know, in the current political climate, that these sort of tiny decisions that we make thousands of every day, if those decisions are slightly inclined in the direction of positive intention, then theoretically the whole outcome could be better. And of course, conversely, if those thousands of decisions are micro inclined towards fear or, you know, xenophobia, then suddenly the whole pattern can be transformed. So in a time that I'm finding, you know, as I'm sure you are, very confusing and very saddening, I'm taking some comfort in the notion that actually the way God designed this world, every action is essential. And I'm finding that sort of empowering in some way.
George, I do want to talk to you about the current political situation. But first, I wanted to ask you about your leap from short fiction, short stories, to a novel. You had to have made a specific decision to go forward with the novel. Why did you, and what was that process like for you?
That's a great question. As I said, I sort of started it on a 3-month grant to myself. Just, you know, try it, and if it doesn't work out, then it's just like you took 3 months off and just went bowling every day. So once I got into it, it started to come alive, and I had it about, I would say, maybe a third of the way finished, and all of the sort of major structural things had been started, and I had it polished pretty well. And then I did what I always do, which is I gave it to my wife, Paula, and I just held my breath. And, you know, we've been married 30 years, and she's a wonderful writer who actually just has a book coming out next year. And she's the best reader, and because she responds very directly and very emotionally. It either moves her or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, then I know I'm doing something wrong. Hmm. So she read it, and she said something that I'm going to keep forever secret, but that was so wonderful that I...
I want to hear what she said.
I had to get her permission first. But it was so dear. And so then I thought, all right, you know, if this person who knows me better than anyone thinks I should go ahead, I will. And at that point, it was maybe 60 pages, and it didn't feel like it could be reduced. So at that point, I said, well, maybe it's a very, very short novella. But I think we were only, you know, an hour into this night at the cemetery. So I mean, one of my policies has been that I, for some reason, I don't write well if I have a big plan, or if especially if that plan involves elaboration. So I've had several abortive novels that just you find yourself writing a 15-page scene about a closet or something just because you thought you were supposed to pad the word count. And so for me, my mind works better if I'm really trying to be efficient. I always say my stories are like a little toy. You wind it up, you put it on the floor, and it goes under the couch. That's the ideal situation. So I kept this one on kind of a short leash. And then finally, when it sort of proved itself, I said, all right, you can go ahead.
You know, it seems to me that what you said is going to give a lot of other writers or would-be writers lots of inspiration and permission to just try something new.
I think so. You know, for me, the big breakthrough in my writing life was when I stopped thinking of the reader as somebody I was doing something to or performing in front of, and started thinking that we were a team. You know, this was an intimate communication, and my job was to honor the reader by assuming her to be just as intelligent and worldly and curious and smart as I was. So in that way, it kind of opens a lot of doors. If you really imagine your reader as being you on a different day, it sort of increases the number of chances you're willing to take. And then also, when 10th of December came out, I had such a nice chance to do a lot of touring and meet readers afterwards. And it never occurred to me before how helpful that is. You sit there and you meet maybe 100 people who read your work, and they're all rooting for you, and they're all willing to take a chance with you. So when I came back from that tour and picked up this book again, I was really encouraged, and I kept all those people in my heart. If I did something that was taking me directly into my own curiosity and my own fears, then they would happily follow. And that was very kind of empowering.
Now, let's talk about politics, because last July, for a piece in the New Yorker about the supporters of Donald Trump, you wrote that you had never before imagined America as fragile, as an experiment that could, within your lifetime, fail, but that now you do. Talk about what you mean.
At that time, when I wrote the piece, it was seemed still unlikely that Trump would even get the nomination, I think. And I felt, just to be frank, how mean-spirited his tone was. The people I met were very nice, but the tone and the kind of strange vacuousness of the language, the constant emptiness of the phrases, the content-free quality of it, and also the kind of the tiny little pod of empathy was just for people who were basically exactly like him or people who liked him. So that was scary. So the fragility also had to do with the fact that when I was out there, it was almost comic the way that, I would sort of show up and say, "Hi, I'm George. I'm a liberal. I'm somewhat left of Gandhi." And we'd have a great conversation. It was kind of like fun, really. We were just with the supporters.
What a great way to introduce yourself.
Yeah, and they loved it. They were like, "Oh, we never met a liberal before." But but the kind of scary thing was that it was always cordial in that American way. You know, people are friendly and they like a laugh and all that. But when we would get to the politics, we would always hit a sticking point. And it came to seem to me that the reason was simply that we were coming out of two different mythological systems that barely intersected in the political sphere.
Mythological? So, what do you mean by that?
Well, I say in the piece, it's kind of like we're two people walking toward what we agree is a castle, but you've only watched Game of Thrones and I've only watched Monty Python's Holy Grail. So there was some sense that I was getting my news and my mental inclination from a completely different place than they were. Which is very, very strange because in, you know, sort of real life, that wasn't the case. We listened to the same bands. We knew the same things about baseball. We had a lot of commonality over affection for our kids and all that. But as soon as it veered off into the overtly political, it felt to me like I was getting, you know, sort of a secondhand version of Fox News. And I'm sure to them it felt something similar, although I became aware that we have to be careful about false equivalencies. But there was really a feeling of deep frustration, I think, on both parts, because you'd get a sort of nice, warm, fuzzy feeling and then say, "Now what about immigration?" And suddenly there was just no, it wasn't a fight, but we'd have these deep, heartfelt conversations and then just both return to our corners, maybe even somewhat reaffirmed. So that scared me because even when I was a kid and during Vietnam, I know that was in many ways a worse time, I think. But you got the sense that there was enough American commonality that you could reason these things out. You could reference commonly held facts that you held in common, and then you could reason through it. And you had sort of a shared sense of respect for factuality and maybe a little bit of skepticism for received information that would make you go find it on your own. And here it almost felt like we were two prize fighters who'd been infused with dogma and then put into the ring. And it still concerns me. And at that time, I don't think I even knew much about the alt-right and those kind of crazy far-right websites. So I had so many interactions after the fact with Trump support, and they'd send me these really strange conspiratorial webpages. And then in at least one or two cases, I worked through it with them. Like, first of all, if the author's name is only attributed as Nick, we have to be suspicious of this. Or if in the banner headlines it says, you know, "Obama to deny food on election day," we might want to be a little skeptical. And the touching and kind of terrifying thing was in both cases when I did it, the person said, "Oh, that's really interesting. I hadn't thought of that. Thank you for, you know, clarifying that."
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. So how do you react to President Trump describing the press or the media as the enemy of the people?
Well, I hate to be blunt, but it's a common demagogue first move. You discredit those who will soon discredit you. And I think that's why he's going after the FBI, too. Whether it's intentional or just the instinct of a showman after all these years, you and I know it's completely not the case. And, you know, that piece at The New Yorker was fact-checked for 9 straight days by 3 different people, including me. Certainly the media gets things wrong, but that's not dishonest. So for someone to issue such a blanket statement, if you say all dogs are evil, you think, well, this guy has something against dogs. There's some agenda here. He doesn't like dogs. He hasn't really gotten to know very many, but he just needs to say that dogs are evil. So I think it's something that everyone, you know, and I have so many friends and family members who are Trump supporters, and I love them dearly, and I it's no problem. But I think all of us, right and left, should look at that statement, enemy of the people, and really perk up our ears at that, because that is not normal business. So,
George Saunders, his newest book, a novel, is titled Lincoln in the Bardo. George Saunders, what a pleasure to talk with you again.
And Diane, can I just say just once more, thank you on behalf of myself and all your listeners over the years, because you have always made my life better and richer, and we're so happy that you're with us.
Oh, thank you so much. Good luck, George.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Last Saturday, President Trump shocked the world with accusations delivered via tweets at dawn that President Obama had ordered the phones tapped at Trump Towers during the presidential campaign. Quote, nothing found, Trump tweeted. Quote, this is McCarthyism.
Have you no sense of decency, sir, at long last?
So, from the archives this week, my 2009 conversation with Robert Shogan, former national political correspondent for Newsweek and the Los Angeles Times, on how the then new medium of live television led to Senator McCarthy's downfall. When you think about journalism at large during the McCarthyism, as it's come to be called, how well did journalism react, cover, expose in general?
I think, as most journalists would concede later, and many of them did at the time, they sort of they were trying to make a living too, and they were operating under the kind of conventions and traditions that governed American journalism at that time. I'm familiar with them because it was around the time I got in. The idea was that if a U.S. senator got up and made a speech and said something provocative, you reported it. And you didn't bother checking it out. You just you were sort of protected from doing that by attributing it to him. And McCarthy understood that. He was very shrewd about playing and exploiting the press. He knew when reporters' deadlines were and when they needed a new lead, and he was almost a genius at doing that.
And you can hear that entire interview at dianereem.org. That's what was on my mind this week. As always, you can let us know what's on your mind. Find us at Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Or you can leave a voice memo at 202-854-8851. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show was produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. I'm Diane Rehm. Thanks, and talk to you next week.